This is an ABC podcast.
Good afternoon. How are you going? I'm Tyne Logan with you for the Country Hour today, filling in for Belinda Varischetti for the rest of the week and also Monday next week. And I've got a lot of really interesting stories coming your way today as well. Have you ever considered pairing your olive oil with your food like you would your wine? Apparently, depending on the region it's grown, extra virgin olive oil tastes very different. And the olive oil industry thinks producers and consumers can capitalise on that. So I'll talk more about that soon. Also, if you tuned into the Country Hour yesterday, you might have heard prices dropped for the sheep at Mouchay. And there's growing concern from farmers that we're now starting to see the fallout from the suspension of Emmanuel's licence for the live sheep trade. So we'll have more on that in the second half of the program, but I am keen to get your thoughts on text as well. 0448 922 604. First today, though, to honey, where the Australian Honeybee Industry Council is questioning the science behind a new report that claims 20% of Australian honey is adulterated. You may have seen the story on the ABC website today. The study, conducted by a team of scientists at Macquarie University, tested 38 Australian branded honey samples.
In terms of Australia, yes, I was a bit surprised that the results were so high, but I suppose in some ways to counterbalance that, we know the issue of adulteration is a prevalent problem, but we didn't think it would be that persistent in Australia from Australian produced products. It did include some boutique brands, and it came from a range of providers. We also tested some Manuka honey, and that failed.
So that's Professor Mark Taylor, who was leading the scientific team behind the study entitled Authenticity and Geographic Origin of Global Honeys Determined Using Carbon Isotope Ratios and Trace Elements. It was peer-reviewed and published in Scientific Reports, and it was provided to a joint investigation by Fairfax Media and the ABC's 7:30 program. But Trevor Weatherhead is the head of the Australian Honeybee Industry Council, and he doesn't think some of the researchers' conclusions make sense.
Well, the headlines didn't make good reading, but once I've started looking into the results and I've been consulting with people, some of the results are very confusing. For instance, in the C4 sugar analysis he's doing, three of the ones from Australia are showing negative results, and people I've consulted says, well, they can't understand how they can get a negative result for that because they're claiming that that means it's adulterated. Well, no one can explain to me why it is. And the two samples from Tasmania, for instance, which probably would be leatherwood, and we know that, for instance, under the Codex Alimentarius, leatherwood can have a higher natural sugar content than other honeys, up to 10%, and that figure was under the 10%, so my reading would be that if it is leatherwood, then it is not adulterated under the Codex Alimentarius.
Did the methodology, do you think, not take that into consideration?
Well, the methodology is giving you the results, but it's the interpretation of the results. I'm not sure if they're aware of this codex existing. It's a worldwide code that's used. And, we've known for years that leatherwood is one of those that has a natural higher sugar contents. Another one is river red gum, lucerne, citrus. They're all got naturally higher natural sugar contents, and so that's allowed for under the codex.
Did the scientific team attempt to get in touch with any honey producers, to your knowledge?
Not that I'm aware of. When we asked for copies of the paper, when we heard about it several weeks ago, one of the authors said, well, they couldn't give it to us because they wanted to publish it and they couldn't do it. Yet, obviously, with the reports that have come out today, they gave a copy to the journo, so that's rather disappointing that they'd give a copy to the journalists but not give us a copy.
At a time when we've seen concerns with strawberries over contamination, are you concerned at all that this could give the impression to consumers that honey is potentially not safe or that there's a problem with it?
Well, I think from the point of view of being not safe and comparing it to strawberries as sort of, like chalk and cheese, it certainly won't hurt you at all, the honey, that's for sure, not like the strawberry contamination. So there's no problem there. The only problem is the perception, people saying that, well, it's not honey, but as I say, looking at his results, I sort of can't quite interpret as to how they're coming up with that result.
Are some of the results correct, do you think? Like, do you think adulteration is happening?
Well, not that we're aware of, particularly with our Australian honey. Most beekeepers would be sitting there this morning having their honey on their toast and sort of saying, well, what's all this about? Because I know what I'm producing, and the product I'm producing is pure Australian honey.
There's a quote in this story saying blended honey of unknown origin has been known to contain antibiotics, toxins, irradiated pollen, even alkaloids with the potential to cause organ damage. What sort of damage does a statement like that do potentially to your industry?
Oh, well, it's one of those statements that's just put out there and with no relevance. It's sort of one of those shotgun effects. You know, you put it out there and hope that something will stick. So if you put enough mud out there, eventually some of it sticks, and there's no verification of that statement for our Australian honey. So just to put something in like that is, rather scary and, I would think a little bit unprofessional.
As an industry, how do you respond now to this?
Well, we'll sort of have to get this paper looked at and see what we can find out from it and see if the interpretations that we're putting on it are correct as well and take it from there. But, the damage is done with something like this, and people doing that, it's not good, and we really have no redress on it at all, because even though we might find out something later on that sort of shows that there's incorrect interpretation of the data, then people won't be interested in it because it's come and gone.
Is there anything that can be done to ensure there is greater testing to improve consumer confidence?
Well, you can have other tests done within Australia on our honey of that, but one of the problems is, of course, we've got a massive different varieties of honey that we produce within Australia. It's not just one type. So you have to get some sort of database to be able to check with that. So that would be one of the problems, is establishing that database. We know from back in 1974, CSIRO did a study on Australian honeys, and in that they found that there was naturally occurring sugars in some honeys, and one of them they identified at the time was white stringy bark. So we know that these naturally occurring honeys that are a bit higher than what some of the standards are that has been shown to happen within Australia. So no one should be worried about that. It's just all natural.
That's Executive Director for the Australian Honeybee Industry Council, Trevor Weatherhead. He was speaking with Jody Gunders. And if you'd like to read the full story on that as well, we do have a link on the ABC Rural Facebook page. I am keen to get your thoughts, though, as well. This is the second report of adulterated honey in Australia in recent weeks. It appears there is a problem. So what's your suggested solution? 0448 922 604. You can also have your say on the ABC Rural Facebook page as well. Jody has done that. She says ACCC need to be issuing massive fines in these instances, and also when products don't meet mandatory safety standards, it seems anything can be sold on the shelves, and we only ask for testing reports when something has gone wrong. Doc says simply don't buy from supermarkets. Local honey is so much better, and he says it's cheaper as well. And Linda agrees. She says buy local, less quality concerns, build immunity to local pollen, and support your local beekeepers. If you'd like to text in, 0448 922 604. Kev has texted in. He says, can anyone out there tell us why the Illawarra adulterated honey is still on the shelves? I don't know, Kev. 0448 922 604. Now, the Macquarie University study looked at 100 samples of honey sourced globally, including 38 samples from Australia. It found that almost 1 in 5 Australian honey samples, including some expensive boutique honeys, are fake. It also found that more than half the samples sourced from Asia were adulterated, most coming from China. IBIS World is Australia's largest industry research company, and it's explored the trend that might have encouraged companies to produce adulterated honey. David Claughton chatted to IBIS World analyst Nathan Cloutman about this most recent damning study on the honey industry.
Yeah, we're seeing that a lot of these investigations are starting to come to light, and there has been previous global investigations into honey adulteration, particularly in the EU. And we're seeing that with rising demand for honey, there is a financial incentive for some producers to kind of fake their output and increase their volumes by adulterating honey.
We spoke to the bee industry earlier today, and they were saying that there is a certain amount of sugar content that you can get naturally, like stringy bark honey, for example, can have up to 10% sugar. So in this study, they're saying that sugars at 9% is adulterated, according to their interpretation. The industry is saying that's not in line with international standards. So have you got any view about this particular study and how robust it is?
Yeah, well, the study was tested at the National Measurement Institute, where they the same place where they test drugs seized by Border Force. And while different investigations have different limits and kind of tests of how they do, a lot of people are starting to say that the test currently for Australian honey is pretty lax and out of date, and where they only test imported honey using the C4 sugar test, which some people are saying is decades old and doesn't really detect syrup such as rice syrup. So I really think there needs to start to be more of a kind of higher standard of testing, particularly for Australian produce.
But in this particular case, the study only took 100 samples globally, and it came out with a result for in New South Wales, for example, where 50% of the samples tested were adulterated, but they only tested two.
Yeah. I think there needs to be a much wider study in terms of the amount of honey products they're testing on supermarket shelves, particularly in Australia. As we're seeing more and more of these investigations come into light, you expect to see a bit more inquiries into. I know the ACCC are looking to launch an inquiry into honey adulteration.
Well, the most outstanding case really is Manuka honey, which the industry grew massively in New Zealand a few years ago, but there's about three times the amount of Manuka honey for sale that is actually produced. So have you been tracking that?
Yeah, well, Manuka honey is highly profitable and can go for very large prices. New Zealand beekeeping industry, what produces Manuka honey, has grown really strong over the past 5 years. And with the rising financial benefits of Manuka honey, you're starting to see more and more is being adulterated.
How do you think this kind of study, this kind of publicity, affects the reputation of Australian and New Zealand honey?
You know, Australia has a reputation for producing high-quality agricultural products, and it's the same in New Zealand. And these investigations are probably going to put a dent into that reputation in terms of honey products. But you think that as demand for honey, both domestically and globally, is starting to really be strong, that it probably won't have as big an effect on honey producers as a kind of scandal would in other kind of products.
Let's just look at the export market, because they are growing quite strongly for Australia. How's it playing out globally?
Yeah, similar to other agriculture industries, we're seeing strong demand from Asian markets such as China, Hong Kong and Singapore. Honey exports are expected to grow an annualised 8.8% over the 5 years through 2018-19. And there's really been strong demand from exports markets in Asia particularly.
There are suggestions that food fraud is a massive industry, $40 billion a year, and getting bigger as criminal gangs exploit what some people regard as weak regulation or outdated government tests like we've been talking about here. And honey is the third most adulterated food in the world, reportedly, behind milk and olive oil. And there's also reports that Chinese vendors are using a website, Alibaba, to sell rice syrups, things that can actually pass some of the official honey tests. What do you think about this growing food fraud industry and the involvement of criminal gangs?
Yeah, we're also seeing that there's a lot of food fraud in terms of fish, and particularly a lot of the fish you sometimes would get in sushi could be not exactly what it's saying on, like, as advertised. We're seeing, like, fish, olive oil, and these trends, as these products are more and more in demand, there is more incentive for, I guess, criminal gangs and companies to kind of adulterate and kind of, like, increase output artificially to get more financial gain.
That's IBIS World analyst Nathan Cloutman. He was speaking to David Claughtman. And on ABC Rural Facebook page as well, Anthony says, name and shame them. What's the point of testing if there's no repercussions? I'd really like to know your thoughts as well on your suggested solutions to the honey industry's two recent reports of adulteration in Australian honey. What do you think is the solution? 0448 922 604. Now, Simon Green is a honey producer in Nanup in WA's southwest. Simon, You're probably happy that WA hasn't been named in this study, but what are your thoughts on how it's going to affect the broader industry?
Oh, I think it's really important to sit down and look at the facts and see exactly what's happening. You know, there's still a bit of cloud over the tests, how the tests have been implemented and how those results need to be analysed. You know, we, as a producer, with our product, we focus on the fact that we're producing 100% pure honey from Western Australian hives, and our biggest limitation for that at the moment is access to forestry and natural resource so that we can actually get hold of this product that we're telling the world that we have. That message just seems to be getting lost a little bit at the moment.
Do you think this is going to have an impact on industry, though, even though there might be a bit of cloud over the research, perhaps prices-wise?
I don't see it'll affect it that much. I mean, there's obviously pressure there for whatever reason for people to import honey to be able to sell a cheaper product that may not necessarily be honey. But for the honey that we're selling and we are exporting overseas, it goes through a lot of testing and there's a lot of quality assurance in place where we can actually trace where that honey's come from. So we can locate the piece of bush that has produced the honey that goes into our jar that goes to market. So we've got full traceability from start to finish. And I think that's what gives the consumer a bit more assurance that they're actually getting that natural product that they're paid for and being told how wonderful it is.
So you think the consumer just needs to look for that labelling assurance that it is quality honey?
Exactly. I mean, so many people just pick stuff up and chuck it in the basket without taking any consideration. Look at the label. There needs to be a little bit of faith in the labelling laws. And if someone's picked up and it is an adulterated product and it has been labelled incorrectly, then that's up to the ACCC to go through and pursue that. But all we can ask is that our customers and consumers pick up the jar, have a look, and, you know, buy off a name that you trust and you believe in. And they should be bringing you 100% pure product. You know, we've got paradise in isolation in Western Australia. We don't need to use antibiotics and chemicals that a lot of other parts of the world have to use in their beekeeping. Let's get this product out there and talk about how wonderful it is and enjoy it.
How is everything actually going production and price-wise for the honey industry right now?
Production's always facing pressures, so we're in a massive prescribed burning period at the moment. So we're seeing millions of dollars worth of crop go up in smoke for our coming jarrah harvest, and it really puts pressure on us because we're running around doing thousands of kilometres trying to find bush to take our bees on, and then to find that resource might undergo a detrimental effect is quite displeasing, and it doesn't help us out at all. You know, beekeeping is an industry that's sustainable. It can only value add to the bush out there by providing pollination, and then we're rewarded with this beautiful product that we can take out and create a market for and create jobs, and, you know, we're not destroying the environment to do it.
Simon Green, thanks for your thoughts today.
No problem at all.
It's just gone... Oh, it's 23 past 12.
My name is Jade.
My name is Annalisa.
My name is George.
My name is Wills.
And you're listening to the Country Hour.
And my name's Tyne Logan. Great to be with you today for the Country Hour. News and weather coming up shortly. And we'll also be checking in with the Katanning sheep sales to see how they fared today. As you might have heard yesterday, sheep prices were down at Mushay, which has prompted a bit of concern from farmers that we're now starting to see the fallout from the suspension of Emmanuel's licence for the live sheep trade. So we'll check in with that shortly. To the north of the state now, though, where a major oil and gas project off WA's Kimberley coast has celebrated an important milestone following the departure of its first shipment of condensate to Asia. The cargo departed from INPEX's offshore floating production, storage and offloading facility moored in the Basin, 220 kilometres northwest of Broome. Ichthys is one of two new LNG projects starting up in the region this year, with Shell also preparing to rev up its Prelude floating LNG plant in 2018. And spokesman Bill Townsend says it's an exciting step forward for the project, which at its peak is expected to produce up to 100,000 barrels of condensate per day.
It's a great day for Inpex and the Ichthys joint venture. It's the first commercial shipment from the Ichthys project, this being condensate from our Ichthys venture, FPSO, which is in the Browse Basin just north of Broome, about 500 kilometres north of Broome. Condensate is a light crude oil that we're producing, and I think it's especially satisfying for us given that it's been 20 years since we were awarded the exploration permit in 1998. It's been some 18 years since we drilled the exploration well that led to the discovery of the Ichthys field, 6.5 years since our final investment decision, which means 6.5 years of construction to get us to this point. We've spent more than 50 billion Australian dollars, and we're finally in a position now to be generating revenue. So a really terrific day for us to celebrate that milestone. We're expecting now 40 years ahead of project life.
Is it easy to explain how many barrels of this condensate get produced on a daily, weekly basis by this project?
Yes. At peak, we expect to produce around 100,000 barrels of condensate per day. We have a floating production storage and offloading facility in the Browse Basin. She's named the Ichthys Venture. And just to give you some figures around that, the FPSO, as it's called, is some 336 meters long, 60 meters wide, has a capacity to hold more than 1.1 million barrels of condensate. So huge all around, and just an enormous facility.
In terms of overall value of that Ichthys project, where does condensate fit in?
Well, condensate is a very important product for us, of course, so certainly does contribute to the economics of the project and makes it, you know, a more sustainable project in terms of economics. I would point out that the Ichthys field itself represents the largest liquid hydrocarbon discovery in Australia since Bass Strait in the 1960s. So a very significant, in this case, condensate discovery for the country and one of the largest ever discovered.
That's INPIX spokesman Bill Townsend. He was speaking to Matt Bran. And later this year, the Ichthys project will commence shipment of cargoes from Bladenport near Darwin, with liquefied natural gas and liquefied petroleum gas exports expected to follow as well. It's 27 past 12. Now, yesterday, Agriculture Minister David Littleproud visited Jamestown, around 60 kilometres east of Port Pirie, where he fielded plenty of questions on the drought. The dry now stretches from southwest Queensland through all of New South Wales, and now, officially as of today, it also is across the southern border, where South Australia's crop forecast is down 2 million tonnes from average. But what does that mean for WA growers, who usually produce grain and fodder for the export markets? And will Australia actually start to import grain this year? Minister Littleproud says shipments have already started to move east.
Well, it already has seen grain from WA in particular start to come around to the east where I live. We've already seen about six or seven shipments come around and a train come across. The reality is that is a real live opportunity for the bumper crop that we've seen despite the frost in some parts of WA for grain to be able to be consumed domestically.
But is there any capacity for the federal government to be involved in that?
Well, that's really a market mechanism, and the reality is the market's already proving itself to be working, that we have the supplies. It's a matter of shipping it around, and as I understand it, it's about $135 a tonne to ship it around, whereas the train's around $200 a tonne. So a lot of the grain merchants in WA are saying to me that they're sending ships around.
And has your department received any requests to import grain?
No, we haven't as of yet, but I have had discussions with large users about the option of being able to do that if the need arises, and we stand ready to make sure that we support that while maintaining the highest biosecurity levels that this country demands.
That's David Littleproud speaking with Lucas Forbes at Jamestown in South Australia. We will have more on grains in the second half of the program as well. And you'll also find out about this new olive oil provenance system that the industry is looking into. Have you ever considered that, you know, your olive oil might work better with certain foods depending on where it's produced. I certainly haven't, but apparently, just like wine, it does taste very different from region to region. So we'll hear about that one shortly. On the text line, in relation to honey, Des says it's simple, really. Ban all honey imports to Australia. This will keep Australian honey pure. There was once a time when it was illegal to import bee products into Australia, including honey. Anthony from Augusta says, we always buy local. You know where it's from, it's cheaper, and you're supporting local business. And Seb says, come on, you people, you have so much trust in the food system. Be paranoid sometimes and question everything in your life. That's the advice from Seb on the text line, 0448 922 604. I would like to know your solution. The honey industry appears to have a bit of a problem, so what's your suggested solution to how they should address it? Right now, we've got news, though, with Vicky Salua. Vicky, what's happening in news?
Thanks. Well, in the headlines, the Prime Minister has dismissed calls from Labor and the states to guarantee in legislation that no state or territory will be worse off under proposed changes to the GST carve-up. Scott Morrison says the coalition will ensure that no state share falls below 75 cents for every dollar of revenue it contributes. The Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, says women will be able to buy sanitary products without paying GST from the 1st of January next year. States and territories have agreed to support the federal government's plan to remove the 10% tax. A convoy of trucks carrying food, clean water, fuel and medicine has entered the city of Palu on the disaster-struck Indonesian island of Sulawesi following last Friday's earthquakes and tsunami. UNICEF says there are a number of challenges facing workers trying to reunite children with parents. And Tennis Australia has made tickets to daytime matches at the 2019 Perth Hopman Cup free for children under the age of 14. The full field for the tournament was announced today and features the first ever showdown between Serena Williams and Roger Federer. I'd love to see that. More news at one.
Thank you, Vicky. I'd love to see that as well.
Yeah.
It is 31 past 12.
The Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
And time now to check in with the weather with Mark Paul. Mark, should we start with the Southwest Land Division?
Yeah, good afternoon. They've got a complex low pressure system that's developing off the coast of the central west, and that's going to track southwards overnight tonight and during tomorrow. We're expecting a band of showers to form through the southern central west, the lower west and the central wheat belt during the afternoon. We're going to see showers and thunderstorms with that, and that should continue to thicken and head southwards overnight tonight and into tomorrow morning. So by tomorrow morning, most parts of the southwest land division will see some showers or thunderstorm activity, with it tending to rain in the southern parts of the lower west, the southwest and the Great Southern. That band of rain will then contract down through the south coastal districts during Thursday. Still the possibility of some thunderstorms associated with that. And then on Thursday's low pressure system more or less moves over the southwest land division, expecting some showers and thunderstorms through remaining parts of the division. As we go into Friday, the upper level feature and the low surface low associated with that feature will contract eastwards. So showers and thunderstorms contracting to eastern parts of the southwest land division during the day, with some showers persisting about the lower west, the southwest and the Great Southern in its wake. And then on Saturday, we should just see some showers more or less about southern coastal parts and adjacent parts of the Great Southern. But then on Sunday, another low pressure system develops offshore from the central west, expecting some afternoon showers and thunderstorms through the central west, central wheat belt, the lower west, and a little bit of shower activity about south and southeast coastal districts in an onshore flow just associated with a ridge to the south of state. Rainfall figures for tomorrow, we're probably going to see around the southwest districts and the Great Southern falls 10 to 15 millimetres through the goldfields and the remainder of the southeast coastal districts, somewhere around about the 5 to 10 millimetres, with 1 to 5 millimetres in the remainder of the southwest land division. Friday, more heavier falls is expected through the southeast coastal district and the adjacent goldfields. 10 to 15 millimetres is possible. The remainder of the southwest land division is somewhere between that 1 to 5 and maybe the southwest district 5 to 10.
Right, fair bit of rain around then. And northern and eastern forecast districts?
Up in the far north in the Kimberley, we're expecting pretty much fine conditions for the next 3 days. On Saturday, there may be one or two afternoon showers just develop through central parts, but there won't be a lot in that. And Sunday, it should be back to fine. Through the Gascoyne, the Goldfields and the interior, and also the Eucla, they're going to experience some showers and thunderstorms through the Gascoyne later on this evening. That'll go into the Goldfields overnight and also the southern interior and Eucla by tomorrow morning. Then pretty much showers and thunderstorms through eastern parts of the Gascoyne, the interior, the Goldfields and Eucla on Friday. And on Saturday, they should be confined to the interior, the southeast parts of the Goldfields and Eucla by Saturday. And then on Sunday, redeveloping back into the Gascoyne and Goldfields, some shower and thunderstorm activity, but persisting also through the interior. So quite a bit of activity coming up over the next few days.
Sounds like it. Any warnings as well?
Yeah, we do have a severe weather warning for the lower west. That's for this evening. We're going to have fresh, gusty, easterly winds. We could see some damaging gusts get up to 90 kilometres an hour around the metropolitan hills. There's also a strong wind warning which extends from Durian Bay around to Israelite Bay.
Mark Pohl, thanks for your time today.
No worries. Catch you later.
And Richard Hudson also joins us in the Perth studios to read through the rainfall figures. Was there much around, Richard?
No, not a lot to get through. The north certainly didn't trouble us, and nothing above about half a mil for the central west, lower west and southwest. In the southern coastal region, just Hopetoun North and Ravensthorpe had 5 mils. All the rest are under that. And there's not many of them. In the central wheat belt, Codgeon had 5, Meriden also had 5, Nanginan with 7, Westonia 6, and Wildcatcham 7. In the Great Southern region, Desert Fringe had 8 and King Rocks had 9. And that's it for the state.
All right. Well, it sounds like you might have a little bit more to get through tomorrow.
Hopefully.
It is 24 minutes. One here on the Country Hour. I'm Tyne Logan, filling in for Belinda Varaschetti for today, for the rest of the week actually, and also Monday next week. Now, you might know it's pretty classic to pair a red wine with a steak, or that, you know, Margaret River, for instance, is known for its Chardonnay. But how much do you know about the specific flavours of the olive oil produced in your region? And what food would that go well with? Just like wine, apparently olive oil has different flavours depending on where it's grown. And as I found out, olive producers in Australia are trying to capitalise on that.
Our olive oils tend to be a mid-level oil. They're not too strong, not too light in flavour. They're good. They're good oils to use in any aspect. So they're not robust, but they're good flavoursome oils. You know, they always taste fresh. Got a grassy note to them.
That's the way Mick Ryan from Preston Valley describes the flavour profile of the olive oil he produces in Donnybrook in the southwest. And if new research by the Queensland Olive Council is anything to go by, that flavour will be unique to his region. The association has just wrapped up a feasibility study into the profitability of creating a geographical origin system for Australian olive growers, similar to that of the wine industry. Dr. Richard Gole is a sensory scientist, olive oil judge, and was the principal researcher on this project, and he says there's a big difference in olive oil from region to region.
I've been chairman of the Australian Extra Virgin Olive Oil competition for over 15 years, and one of the most common questions was, is extra virgin olive oil different from region to region? And I had to say, I mean, my gut feeling that it was, because I could actually pick differences in olive oil myself, but we didn't have any evidence for that. So we put together a project to see whether or not we could validate what I thought was what was true.
And could you?
Yes, we did. We got olive growers from the Fleurieu Peninsula in South Australia, which is the area just south of Adelaide, and we got olive growers from southeast Queensland in the higher parts around Toowoomba and in the Burnett Valley just below that, and we showed that they were different, which was that these were all from the same variety as well, which was important.
How big was the difference?
What we found was that although the olives were coming from the two regions, they were the same variety, and they were picked at the same ripeness, and they were processed in exactly the same way, they had a unique chemical fingerprint. When I say chemical fingerprint, I mean in terms of their things like polyphenols, which are important for health. There's another compound called squalene, which is actually also very healthy for you, and another compound called tocopherol, which is a type of vitamin E. And we found that between the two regions, there were differences in basically the profile of these compounds, and also when we tasted the oils, they actually tasted different.
You said you are an olive oil judge, though, as well. Do you have a particularly good palate when it comes to telling the difference between olive oils? Is this something that that the general consumer would be able to tell the difference between as well?
When we did the taste testing of the oils from the two regions, we used growers from the two regions as our tasting panel. And, you know, the growers are pretty good tasters, but they're not, you know, they're sort of halfway between super experts and naive consumers. So I think it was a pretty good taste test.
It's a difference that Amanda Bailey from the Queensland Olive Council says producers need to capitalise on.
So we actually found out that about 94% of growers would be able to benefit from this single estate / provenance type class. We also found that anywhere else in the world where a designation of origin had been defined, that producers there typically gained higher prices for their products as opposed to when they weren't defined. We worked out that, yeah, it would cost about 4 cents per litre to be able to implement a provenance type system throughout the olive industry.
And what's the higher price that you'd get per litre?
Well, in some areas, you know, and it's like cheeses and things like that, you know, like consumers will pay a premium price for something that they know is authentic. And so, you know, in some cases, you know, the prices were as much as 50% higher.
They're also setting up a website that will help consumers in their buying decisions.
One of the first questions is how do I find my local producer? So that's hopefully going to help answer some of those questions. And from that, you know, we'll be able to come up as an industry with a whole heap of different materials to help consumers understand a bit more about the diversity, because the diversity of olive oil is as diverse in flavour profile as wine.
And will there be a way for consumers to know what nuttier olive oil, for instance, would go with compared to a sweeter olive oil, how they should use the different flavours?
Yeah, so through the website, that's also something that we want to do is have food pairing, is to actually be able to show consumers how to use olive oil better, you know, from a culinary sense, you know, with different things that they're making at home. So, yeah, we hope that, you know, it's like when you have, say, a dinner party, you don't have the one wine necessarily. You know, there's a wine that goes particularly with that dish better than what it would with, say, something else. And olive oil is exactly the same in that way as well.
Well, it's still a while off and there's still plenty more studies to be done. It's news that certainly got the industry excited. Here's producer Mick Ryan again.
Yeah, I think anything that can help promote, you know, regional oils is good for the region and it's good for the industry. Our oil's different to oils up from Gingin, say, or down in the Great Southern. I think anything that helps identify the origin of oils is going to be a benefit.
That's Donnybrook olive oil producer Mick Ryan ending that story. And there you go. We could be seeing quite a few more olive oil connoisseurs in the future as well. Now, if you drive a truck at harvest time, how fast do you go? What about when you're off the bitumen and on an unsealed road? The reason I'm asking is because the City of Greater Geraldton has requested grain and harvest related trucks keep speed on gravel roads to 70 kilometres an hour or less. It's going to impact farmers like Rod Messina from Mullawa, but he says keeping speeds lower is a good idea.
Yeah, look, I think it's a great initiative by the city, and it's great to see them proactive. And I think, you know, even locally for us, talking to our foreman of our roads and stuff like that, it's we sort of tried it a couple of years ago. Just, you know, it doesn't take long. People talk about the length of trucks and things like that damaging our roads. Well, you know, in my opinion, it's the speed. We've all got, you know, these trucks are getting bigger and bigger horsepowers, and if they're running doubles, then, you know, they're belting along at 100 k's an hour and the trailers are sort of moving all over the shop, and that's, you know, that's what's doing the damage. Whereas if you slowed down and took it a bit easier, I think, you know, the roads would last longer for everyone, because, as we know, we can't really... It's very hard to grade and put enough water on a dry road during the harvest to sort of maintain it. So if we can sort of preserve the condition that it's in at the start of harvest, well, yeah, I take my hat off to the city for implementing something like that.
So that's driving trucks at that speed when they're empty and as when they're full is just as important? Or if
yeah,
not
absolutely.
More important? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they'll move around more when they're empty. We've told our own truck drivers for years now, you know, I only like them doing sort of 95 on the bitumen and sort of 80 at the most on the gravel. So we've sort of, I guess we've had our own policy like that. But I think, yeah, I know you do see contractors and guys that, you know, they think they're going to belt along to get to the bin 10 minutes quicker. And a lot of it is too to do with safety and school bus routes and things like that as well.
There is also, as you've touched on it already, there are people, of course, who believe they can get an extra load in a day and, of course, make extra money and they're there to make a living. Can it be enforced? Because we do know that some people will drive faster than 70 k's, won't they?
Yeah, look, I guess at the end of the day, I think it's up to the truck operator and even the owner of, you know, contracting businesses. We all understand at the end of the day, we all want to get our grain to port or to CBH, you know, as quick as we can, and no one likes standing around, you know, waiting for trucks. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, the tons that are there at the start of harvest are the same tons that are going to be there at the end of harvest. And at the end of the day, it might mean an extra day of carting at the end or things like that. But look, I think it's more about safety. You know, there's going to be a lot more trucks on the road this year, both on the bitumen and on the gravel. And there's probably going to be a lot of contractors or subbies that are coming to the Midwest and the Wheat Belt that aren't familiar with these areas. So, you know, it's about everyone just slowing down. You know, the old slogan they used to run, you know, be courteous on the roads. Well, I think that's even more paramount now. The trucks are getting bigger. And, you know, there's more trucks on the road as well as we share the road with school buses and, you know, wives and kids going to Geraldton or, you know, wherever yes. they are. It's, yeah, we just, you know, slow down and we'll get all our grain to port. And I think if the farmers, the truckies and the contractors can all work together and, you know, I guess no one wants to be, it's impossible to police it, but I think if we all work together and sort of just take a deep breath, then we'll all get through harvest.
That's Mullawa farmer Rod Messina with his thoughts on the city of Geraldton, which covers Mullawa these days, which is asking harvest trucks to restrict speeds to 70 kilometres per hour. And speaking of road transport as well, Main Roads WA has made some changes to the harvest mass management scheme for this coming harvest. We were talking about it a while ago when they said farmers and contractors needed to submit a form to get permission for a truck to travel on every road that isn't approved for heavy vehicles. This is roads that aren't on the restricted access vehicle network as well. So typically a smaller road linking your paddock to a bigger road would be what they mean. But we've also been hearing these changes mean some trucks will have to dramatically reduce their speed on some of these smaller roads as well. On Twitter, a Bolgart farmer was saying he thinks the rules are confusing, but as he understands it, he'll have to do 40 kilometres an hour on a 20 kilometre stretch of road with a flashing light to reach a road on the RAV4 network. So it's certainly impacting him a lot. Previously, he would have been able to do 70 kilometres an hour. Oh, got a frog in my throat. He'd previously would have been able to do 70 kilometres an hour on those roads, and he's also worried about the flashing light requirement as well, because this may mean that he can't travel at night. So keen to get your thoughts on this one. Have those changes to the harvest mass management scheme confused or annoyed you? The text number is 0448 922 604.
Hi, my name's Bryden Bell and I'm from the Kimberleys and you're listening to The Country Hour.
It's 12 minutes to one and a bit of a grains update for you as well at the moment. The warm, dry September we experienced has certainly sped up the finish to grain season in the northern ag region this year. There is canola swathed in some paddocks now, which means it could be delivered by next week. And there could even be some wheat coming off from the very north as early as next week. There is some weather coming through in the next few days, though, and that's expected to slow things down in the paddock. The Geraldton port zone is still headed for a good harvest this year. The Kwinana port zone is on track for above average yields as well. In the southern parts of the state, though, especially around the lakes area, bit of the shine has been taken off from that frost that swept over the Great Southern a week and a half ago, and harvest is still a way off yet for the southern port zones as well. Also, I've just read a tweet from Mikado saying that someone is quite proactive, locking in a $357.50 on ASX for the 2021 harvest. So pretty ballsy, if I'm allowed to say that on air. What are your thoughts on that? Is the buyer or the seller best placed? 0448 922 604.
Catch up with your favourite ABC radio program anytime, anywhere with ABC Podcasts. Hear conversations with Richard Fadler. Explore some little-known Australian history with Rum, Rebels and Ratbags. Catch up on news and current affairs. Plus there's music, religion, science and sport. There's a great range of ABC radio podcasts for you to explore, and all in your own time. Just search online for ABC Podcasts.
Now, there's an interesting example of one of these grower-driven ag tech startups. It's a fresh produce phone app, and it's called Fluencia. And it's the brainchild of Anthony Joseph and his brother, whose family have been involved in the horticulture industry for more than a century. The app shares market information in real time across the supply chain between growers, market agents and retailers. And Mr. Joseph says his app tries to increase the transparency and help growers make informed management decisions.
Yeah, so basically, what we understand is there's a sophisticated, complex supply chain at the moment whereby a grower will harvest his produce, he will send it either direct to a retailer or customer or into the market to be sold. At the moment, the only connection the grower has with those customers and with the market is quite opaque and hard to see. So, you know, what it means is that now growers can actually, you know, from the palm of their hand, actually see who their produce is being sold to and for how much in real time, and actually use that information to drive meaningful decisions about how and what they're producing and when they're harvesting. Activating the existing supply chain is where we've really targeted, you know, what we're doing here.
Why did you start developing this platform?
Yeah, look, our family has been involved in the horticultural industry in Australia for 103 years this year. So having seen the changes that we have seen in the last 10, 15, 20 years, the increase in demand beyond Australia, there's some significant challenges in what we do day to day. Fresh produce supply chains are largely inefficient and wasteful. And when we talk about waste, our thoughts immediately go to rotting food or crops being left in the paddock. You know, the waste I'm talking about is hidden and hard to see. It's the farmer that could have picked a patch of tomatoes a day earlier or later to meet the real demand in the market, or the greengrocer that cannot secure supply next week because they have no connection with their grower. You know, the late trucks to market or the decision to pick before the rain because you know your customer's needs for next week and you have confidence that you'll get the right money if you pick that fruit before a weather event.
Glenn Pereira, you're the supply chain lead for Green Beans, a veggie company over in Queensland. When you got behind this platform, what made you think that this could help you achieve those goals of, you know, more transparency and communication within your supply chain?
We, at the current stage, rely heavily on phone conversations made, and there is a delay between the data getting to us as the manager of the supply chain, but also to the hundreds of people within that value chain, from the growers, the harvesters, the packers, the transport and logistics people, the hundreds and thousands of people around Australia in fresh produce who actually try to deliver the best quality produce they can to the consumer. We're at the initial stages of working with the new technology, and we're looking forward to the positive influence it has on how we operate. But it's really about one could say it's really about the growers that are under continued and ongoing pressure to change direction every day, every hour, to manage the impacts of weather, competition, long value chains. These things change every day, and hopefully the technology, through its instantaneous feedback of value, volume and quality, will help us make decisions to improve the business of delivering healthy consumer options. And as Anthony was saying, to compete not only on a local and domestic front, but also on a world stage.
That's Green Beans supply chain lead Glenn Pereira speaking to John Daly.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Rachel Mealy. On the program today, goodbye to the tampon tax. States and territories agree to remove the 10% GST on sanitary products. What will it take to fix a backlog of cases in the family law system? We speak to a former judge of the family court. And for the first time in 50 years, a woman wins the Nobel Prize for Physics.
Well, I'm sure it's relevant, but I don't think it's the main thing. I don't want to take away from the two men that won their Nobel Prize, that the big story is that I'm a woman winning it. I would say that it's great that times are changing.
More than the headlines, The World Today.
It's 5 minutes to one, and just about to head to Katanning to find out what numbers and prices were like at this morning's sheep sales. But if you tuned into the Country Hour yesterday, you might have heard prices came back a bit for sheep sold at Mushay. Philip George is a sheep farmer at Gingin. Did you sell some yesterday, Philip?
Yes, Ty, I did. I sold some lambs, but the lamb price had come back a fair bit, but it was the mutton price that actually astounded me. Dropped sort of $15 to $20 a head. And I think it's all caused because of the backup of the sheep that haven't been exported. It's just starting to come in onto the market now. And the thing going around the traps is that the processors are chock-a-block full. They're battling to handle any more. Now, the worst part about this whole setup is that I can see is Alana McTiernan turned around. She, early on in the piece, was the one that stirred the possum to get all this live export shut down. She's pretty well got what she wanted. But now, when the farmers are losing money hand over fist, you know, she's gone into the background. No one can hear from her. No one's seen her. She hasn't come back with a solution. And if you did get her in a corner, what she's going to do, she'll turn around and say, oh, it's the federal problem. David Littleproud, it was, you know, it was him who did it. You know, for an ag minister, what she hasn't got the qualifications to be anyway, you know, she should be up front and trying to help the farmers with this price, because it's going to get worse with the backlog of live export sheep that are still sitting in WA that haven't gone.
Alana McTiernan has recently been quite outspoken in that she is saying that she supports the industry, and also she says that she's trying to get more investment into abattoirs locally. Do you think that's enough?
No, it's not, Ty, because the problem is with the industry, it doesn't stop. You know, it's spring, fair enough. There's extra sheep coming onto the market, especially mutton, and there's those new lambs coming through, hoggets coming through. It's not a thing that you can chop off 1 month and then expect it's going to fix itself within 2 or 3 months. It's an ongoing industry. And as soon as she realises, you know, what the farming game entails, she might be better off, because I think that just absolutely is stupid what has happened with the sheep side of it here in WA.
All right, well, we'll get to the Katanning sheep sales now. Total yarding today is 14,683, and numbers are up 2,500 on last week. Tracy Kuhn is at Katanning now. Tracy, can you run us through the prices, please?
Yeah, so base.
Heavy lambs eased $4 with a top price of $145 paid by processors, and feeders paid up to $140 for the good quality lambs. The lightweight lambs saw values gain from last week with more interest from feeder buyers. A large yarding of mutton saw values ease $5 and up to $18 for ewes with no fleece value. Restockers paid up to $142 for young ewes, while processors paid $125 a head for heavy ewes with a 150mm fleece. The new season lightweight lambs gained, selling for $64 to $105, while the very light under 12 kilo carcass weight eased, making from $31 to $78 with a fleece. Heavier lambs gained with air freight weights making from 95 to 118. Trade weight lambs sold for $125 to $139 to $144 and heavy lambs to $145. The old season trade weight lambs sold from $115 to $120, while lambs suitable for air freight made from $95 to $112 a head, including skins. The lightweight crossbred lambs to processors returned $47 to $100 to average $70 a head. Good quality heavy mutton over 24 kilos carcass weight sold from $70 to $125, including skins, to average $3.58 a kilo carcass weight. The medium weight used in the 18 to 23 kilo carcass weight range made from $50 to $118 with a full fleece. Light store boning used down to 14 kilos carcass weight made from $40 to $50, while heavier boners returned $75 to $118 a head with a 150mm fleece. Weathers sold mainly to processors for $60 for lightweights under 18 kilos carcass weight and $85 to $120 for the heavier weathers, while restockers paid $45 to $125 a head, depending on weight and fleece value.
Thank you, Tracy. And that's all from the Country Hour today. Thank you for your company. I'll be back with you again tomorrow and for the rest of the week. Right now, though, it's news time.